Good morning, everyone. So we've introduced our prophet by looking at the one of the factors of prophecy is that the book that we have has its origins clearly in the words of Jeremiah. But we have to understand that the way they dealt with it is in history, as further insights came to them in the light of their experiences during the exile, after the exile, etc., with the Greek invasion and all of that, the scribes, as they saw it, discovered meanings in this living text that comes from a living God. And having discovered those meanings, they made them explicit in the text itself. So the text itself is drawing on Jeremiah, but also it's alive and right through probably till the second century before Jesus, is being adapted and opened up because of further insight. I hope that's clear to you, though it's a very general statement I'm making. Then we saw that, going back to Jeremiah now, or any prophet, they're not concerned with the future. They're concerned with real people in a real situation, and they're drawing out what they see God is trying to say to them about their life, the living God. And so the history is critical. Jeremiah did some of his prophesying during the reign of Josiah, which we've looked at, but most of it was in the time of Jehoiakim, the last 10 years leading into the destruction or the capture of Jerusalem and then the first exile, and during his successor, which was Zedekiah, during the exile's already going, but these are 10 more years and it finally leads to the destruction of Jerusalem. So poor Jeremiah's living in those 20 years, a tumultuous period of time. So we're not surprised that a whole lot of his, as we'll see, words are about the oncoming disaster and last attempts to get the people to change, or if it's too late, if Jerusalem's already been captured, trying to help the exiles and help the people back in Judah to repent of what they do and lest it happen again. We've done that, I think, and we've looked at two of the contemporary prophets, Zephaniah and Habakkuk. And now I've got one last piece, and we'll move into Jeremiah in this session, but one last piece needs to be put in place, and that is the exile in Babylon. The first 10 years of it, the first exile, leading up to the, and between that and the destruction of Jerusalem, that 10-year period. Let's look at the exile, because that's what he's writing about, fearing its approach, but then speaking about it. So I'll do that with you first, then we'll move into the prophet himself. That small, sketchy map I've offered you there is just to show you where. There's Jerusalem here. This is the Arabian desert here. There's no way of crossing from Babylon to Jerusalem that way, from east to west. It's desert, and they had no way of doing it. So frequently you're going to see in the prophecy of Jeremiah, he talks about the enemy of the north. Well, it's the enemy of the north because they go up the river and then down here. That's that arc is the way they approach. So they're coming from the north. You can't come from the east. And there's Babylon there. And the Tigris River, the Euphrates River, Mesopotamia, as they call it. So we're dealing with central and southern modern Iraq. This is a statement taken from the Babylonian Chronicles, nothing to do with the Bible, but a concurrent statement made that they dug up from Babylon. And it reads like this, giving their account of what happened. In the 7th year, the month of Kislev, that's December to January, the king of Akkad, the Akkadians, this is the people we're talking about, mustered his troops, marched to the Hatti land, and encamped against the city of Judah, meaning Jerusalem. And on the second day of the month of Adar, that is, if you want the exact date, March the 16th, 597 BC, he seized the city, captured the king, whom we know was the young prince, really, but 3 months he was king because his father died during the siege. That's Jehoiakim. He appointed there a king of his own choice, and we know that as Zedekiah, received a heavy tribute and sent them to Babylon. That's the Babylonian account of what we're dealing with. In 597, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon captured Jerusalem. King Jehoiakim, sometimes called Jeconiah or Coniah, the leaders and the artisans were taken hostage and deported. Anyone who was of any use to the war over that part of the world, to the Babylonians. Jehoiakim retained his kingly status and he was released while still in exile in 561. So he was treated with respect over there as a king. That was the year after the death of Nebuchadnezzar. Once Nebuchadnezzar died, his successor freed the king and he died in freedom in Babylon. That account is given in the second book of Kings. The records of the numbers taken into exile vary, and I've got no way of improving on any of this. In the first book, second book of Kings, chapter 24, it speaks of 10,000, a round figure, of course, people exiled. Later in the same chapter in 2 Kings, it speaks of 7,000 plus 1,000 craftsmen. Obviously adds up to 8,000. So was it 10 or 8? The scribes like to keep everything intact, lest the meaning be lost. So there must have been two traditions, and they put them both in, so that they wouldn't lose anything. And Jeremiah himself, or in the prophetic scroll of Jeremiah 52, speaks of 3,023 from Judah. And presumably, we have to add to that the number from Jerusalem. So that might give you some idea. From the book I offered you to look at yesterday by Finkelstein and Silbermann, they have worked out that 75% of the population stayed behind in Judah. So the top 25% were exiled. And that's anyone who's anybody, with any particular skill or any particular government or public service or whatever. The farmers were left behind. The Babylonian exile demanded an enormous religious adjustment. In spite of all the hopes built upon promises understood to have come from their God, the promised land had been taken from them. Israel, a century and more before, had collapsed, never to be restored, and now Judah is taken. They've got nothing left. The promised land is now basically empty. Despite the assurances that they'd been given that Jerusalem would not be defeated by a foreign king, and a lot of the inverted commas prophets were saying that, these assurances were reinforced when Sennacherib failed to capture the city in 701, even though he took the whole of, devastated the rest of Judah. In spite of that promise, as they understood it, the Babylonian army had razed Yahweh's city to the ground. That's the second exile period. Despite assurances that God would guarantee the dynasty of David, on your throne you will have a son forever and ever and ever, hallelujah, all that stuff that you can still read. In spite of that, there's no king. In fact, there will never be a king again. Now, from the New Testament point of view, I'm sure you can see, they see Jesus, king in a different sense, of course. My kingdom is not of this world. But they see Jesus as the one who is the son of David, carrying on the promises. But from a Jewish point of view, they're still waiting, hoping for this Messiah. Despite their belief that the temple was the house of their God, Yahweh, no God can be more powerful than our God, Yahweh, in spite of that, the temple in 587 was razed to the ground. Any national institutional basis for their religious identity had been swept away. So put yourself in exile with them. And imagine what it's like. They've lost their land, they've lost their temple, they've lost their king, they've lost everything except their faith. Many of them lost their faith too, no doubt. But there was that faithful group that kept re-looking at their documents and trying to see meaning in it and trying to find another way of being who they are. And this is a bit of an odd idea just flipped into my mind, but you've heard a lot of my odd ideas, I suppose. But I'm just thinking, as a Catholic, if all the cardinals of the world were in the Vatican, in Vatican III, and the bloody bomb landed on it and Rome was to the ground, there's no Pope, there's no cardinals, don't cheer. But anyhow, all that is going on, perhaps, well, we have to find faith is bigger than any of that. It would kind of shatter expectations, but there'd have to be a way of us getting together, and that's what they did. They formed synagogues. It's the first time they had synagogues. They'd come together, talk, pray, read, discuss, and the Jews are still doing it on the synagogue. Hold while the temple isn't gone and all of that. So that in exile, they had to rethink everything. If they're going to retain any sense of themselves as a people, they had to discover a firmer basis for their faith than land, king, and temple. Beautiful as all those are. They had to learn a new humility, find a deeper faith in God, independent of political and economic success. And it's not far to jump. Be an early Christian. Be a disciple of Jesus. Be Judas, who was obviously a leader and maybe the best of them, who knows. But then Jesus is crucified, the one you put all your hopes in and dreams in. And Judas himself still never quite got the message, unfortunately. So he organized for Jesus to be captured by the Romans, fully conscious of the fact that when they did, Jesus would win, obviously. But he was trying to get Jesus to stand up to them and show his... But he had it all wrong. But put yourself in that group and how shattering it was, those two people, husband and wife, perhaps, or two, whatever they were, two disciples going back to Emmaus, losing their hope, and everything was buried in the garden with Jesus. And somehow or other, they had to find something different, and they found the Spirit in the community. And then you get Paul, one of the great enemies, converted to Christianity, and the rest of the story you know. But our faith ultimately has to be faith. However much help or hindrance we're getting from the institution or the community. They had to learn a new humility and a deeper faith in God. In fact, they're the words Jesus used to Peter when they were watching the temple, and Jesus said the temple's going to collapse, and Peter's wondering what to do, and Jesus says, have faith in God. So we're right back to basics here. Independent of political and economic success. In Babylon, they found themselves living in what was in many ways a superior culture. The language is superior, science was already emerging from there, astrology and so on, was a strong culture. And they came from a little backwater up on a hill called Jerusalem, and there's hardly much to it, and with a little tiny language that's beautiful, but tiny. Then they go into this world with Aramaic and all the rest of it. So they're in a superior culture, but, and this was a major thing that they experienced in exile, religiously these people were pathetic. They didn't have any mountains. Of course you don't have mountains. It's the Tigris and Euphrates River. It's an alluvial plain. So there's no mountains. They had to build their own mountains. And they had to build their own gods, for God's sake. This is how it looked like to the Jews. They had these things like that, statues. Now, the Jews misunderstood them, as we often do with other religions. They thought they were worshipping this bit of stone. Well, of course they weren't. That was a symbol of a spirit, a god somewhere. But it was all very pathetic and primitive compared to what they'd inherited, this unknown god, this unnamed god, this presence that's everywhere. Now, they're in a little tiny world in Judah, but they've still got this profound insight into this mystery that we're calling God. There wasn't much profound going on in the stock exchange over in Babylon. So the concept of monotheism starts to emerge. They'd thought that all these people have gods. Babylon had its god. And they saw the god of Babylon on the back of a cart being dragged out somewhere. And they thought, what the hell's going on here? Then you see in Isaiah, not here in Jeremiah, they start to think, well, heavens, maybe our God is their God too, if only they knew it. Maybe it's just the beginnings of monotheism, one God everywhere. And thank God it's our God who is the one God. The Yahweh, I mean. So the sense of missionary vocation emerges, and you find that in the book of Isaiah, which is written in exile, this part of the Isaiah scroll. They felt that these poor people, with all their wealth and all their intellectual might and all that, they really need help. They're desperate. The sense of mission, and you get some of the stuff there in that part of Isaiah, go to the Torah must be taken to the ends of the world, and the islands are awaiting your Torah, and so on. Instead of identifying themselves now in relation to the Davidic dynasty, which has ended, they began to see themselves as a community defined by worship, prayer, communal prayer, and not in the temple. In the absence of the temple, they began to come together to remember and to pray. This was the beginning of the institution of the synagogue, which has remained central to Judaism ever since. They had to ask themselves how the loss of the land, the temple and the monarchy could have happened. And maybe we, I'm going right outside my, but maybe we need to learn from this. Because I grew up in a church where, and it was beautiful, nothing against it, still don't have nothing against it, but the Mass on Sunday was the big thing. But at home, we, for example, we had eight kids, mum and dad, we used to say the family rosary every night, and maybe many of you had a similar thing. It was something that happened in the home. It wasn't all just there in the community. But the coming of Vatican II, we lost a lot of that. So, and I don't know that it's been replaced. I've been working in parishes for over 20 years before I came here, and prayer in the home really wasn't. I couldn't think of what to do, but I'm hoping one of you can. A way of praying, a way of being community in the home. I'm sure in many other people's parishes it's happening. And we had prayer groups and all that. It wasn't empty. But we've got to be less reliant on the institutional prayer and more sharing at home, I think. That's probably obvious. They had to anyhow. It was impossible for them to contemplate the possibility that their God, Yahweh, was weaker than the gods of the Babylonians. That was obviously not true to them. So they concluded, this is logical, that it must have been their God who brought about the catastrophe that they were experiencing. It must have been their God that inspired the Babylonians to come and destroy Jerusalem. God must have wanted Jerusalem to be destroyed, and God's not unjust, so it must have been because of our behaviour. So they're thinking, what do we do? And that's when they're writing the Torah out in exile. They've got nothing else to do. The priests, there's no sacrifices. So they've got all this time on their hands, and there's a lot of writing going on and scribal activity and different schools of thought coming together, and which the Jews are good at, thank you. You've got argument, debating, intellectual confrontation of points of view, and out of it is emerging the Torah that we now have. God's will, and they don't want to ever disobey it again. Where had they gone wrong, they're thinking? In exile. You and I, we're over in exile with the 25% that are there, the people who can read and write and whatever. What must they do to bring about the purification without which they couldn't enjoy God's blessing? These are some of the questions that were being asked by a number of different schools during the long years of exile. I don't mention them here, but the Deuteronomic school is a very important one that thrived during Josiah's reign back in Judah. And they were responsible for the book of Deuteronomy and for the Deuteronomic, inverted commas, because it's not history, it's prophecy, the books of Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings. A massive amount of the Old Testament comes from this vibrant school that's looking into the spirituality of Israel. That's one of them. The Isaiah school is another. And there's a priestly school as well. Ezekiel may well have been one of them. Priests who are, up till then, they learned how to be a priest from their father, because the firstborn son automatically of a priest was automatically a priest. And so they'd learned it from their father. Now they're in exile. How are they going to teach it to their children? They can't take them to the temple with them, the young men, I mean, and let them see what's happening and learn that way. So they've got to have it written down, lest it be forgotten. So that's going on as well in this amazing, rich period of spiritual renewal, which we call the exile. We're left to imagine the dialogue, debate and discussion that went on between these different schools' points of view as they struggled to make sense of what was happening to them. So, with that behind, let's look at the prophet Jeremiah. The bulk of Jeremiah's oracles are located in the reigns of Jehoiakim, that's 609 to 598, 10 years effectively, and his brother Zedekiah from 597 to 587. That's the bulk of it. Jeremiah was a lone voice. Lone voice. We've actually heard little bits for brief periods of Zephaniah and Habakkuk, and we didn't look at Nahum, but we mentioned him. But on the whole, he's a lone voice. And his contemporaries dismissed him and his oracles as the ravings of a religious crank. Moreover, there was no lack of self-acclaimed prophets who kept reassuring the people that it was impossible for Jerusalem to fall since it had the security of guarantee by Yahweh. Jeremiah kept insisting that their security depended on their fidelity. No one wanted to listen to him. In 597, the Babylonian army captured Jerusalem and the leaders were taken into exile. As we read Jeremiah, quite a bit of it comes before that, trying to avoid it, this catastrophe. Zedekiah, that's the one that was appointed by the Babylonians, the brother of Jehoiakim, he was put on the throne after that group had been exiled. He kept vacillating between submission to Babylon, which involved a lot of money, tribute, wasn't easy, they would have wanted to throw off that, and courting favour with Egypt, because Egypt and Babylon were on opposite sides here. Babylon had defeated Egypt and Assyria back in at the Battle of Carchemish, 605, mentioned yesterday. So they're the rivals, and so he is in the middle, this tiny little Judah, and the king, Zedekiah, is wondering whether he should pretend to be with the Babylonians, that's safer, or try and get on the side of the Egyptians and hope they can defeat the Babylonians. So that's all. Now, with all that vacillating, the Babylonians got sick of it, so they came over and just, first of all, besieged the city, and then crushed it. In 588, the Babylonian army again laid siege to the city, and this time they showed no mercy. The city was burnt, the temple was razed to the ground, and more people were taken into exile. It was the end of an era. And many of them would have thought that the northern kingdom, when it collapsed, never came back. So they probably thought, that's the end. That's the end. Why would anyone allow them to go back home? Jumping ahead, the story is that the Persians under Cyrus conquered Babylon, and the king of the Persians had a whole different system. He allowed all the peoples to go back and build their own temples and have their own religions as long as they paid tax. He was a much more astute leader than the Babylonians. And so they were allowed to go back. It was a miracle, unbelievable miracle, after 50 years and 60 years of exile. But when they're in exile, they're not expecting that. It was the end of an era. And Jeremiah is writing during that 10 years between the first and second exile. Judah, the last of the tribes of Israel, was utterly devastated. It was Jeremiah's lot to minister as a prophet during the terrible final years of Judah's decline. This accounts for the unrelenting criticism of the policies that led to the disasters of 597 and then 10 years later 587, and the dire warnings of divine punishment that all but fill the scroll of Jeremiah. To read the Jeremiah scroll, we need to put ourselves among the exiles in Babylon as they tried to grasp what they understood as Yahweh's will in using the Babylonians to humble Judah. We need to picture the elders, the priests, the scholars of various schools struggling to understand what had gone wrong. Jeremiah's oracles would have been an important source for their reflections, and their insights are incorporated into the scroll. Some of these insights are expressed in homiletic form, preaching, aimed at inspiring the other exiles to learn from Jeremiah. As one would expect, the homilies expressed what Yahweh had revealed to Jeremiah by drawing out the implications of Jeremiah's words in ways that connect with the exiles' experience. I've said that a few times. The scholars suggest that it's most likely that the poetic parts of Jeremiah, and I'm not distinguishing them here with you, it's too subtle and it's important, but I'm limited in what I'm able to do in this time. So the poetic parts are probably Jeremiah. The prose are probably later understandings of the poetry. And so we begin again. I've done this with you on the first night. I don't expect you to remember, but the first three verses of Jeremiah's prophecy are the words of Jeremiah, son of Hilkiah, of the priests who were in Anatot, in the land of Benjamin. Now, Benjamin is a tiny little area just north of Jerusalem. And then you've got the Judah, a big tribe, and north of Benjamin you've got Ephraim and Manasseh, the big tribe there. And then you've got all the other ones in different places. So squashed in between them is this tiny little... That's why the first king of Israel was a Benjaminite, because they could control him. He's only from a small tribe. The other two wouldn't allow anyone from there or anyone from here to be king. So he came from there, and Anatot, as I mentioned earlier to you, was where one of the priest who founded that area was exiled to Anatot because he was against Solomon and was in favour of one of the other ones to become king. text goes on, to whom the word of Yahweh came in the days of King Josiah, son of Amon of Judah, in the 13th year of his reign, 627 BC, is the beginnings of the prophetic ministry. It came also, and most of it came, in the days of King Jehoiakim, son of Josiah of Judah, and until the end of the 11th year of King Zedekiah, the son of Josiah of Judah, until the captivity of Jerusalem in the 5th month, 587. So that's the scribes, they've put that at the top. That's their understanding, and we're not going to do any better. They were closer to it than we are, and scholars agree that's what's happened. There's an enormous amount written on the prophecy of Jeremiah. In fact, I myself have read an enormous amount on it. Different scholars, you know, the last one I read was 1,200 pages of scholarly stuff by Halliday. I'll give you some of it in a minute, though I'd read it 20 years ago, but I reread it for a few of this retreat. But there's other people like Carroll and McCain, whom I'm asking you to believe me. I mean, there are massive scholars working at all this, and people like me are able to glean from them their life's work, what then I'm able to handle to you as best I can. So Carroll, for example, in his book on Jeremiah, states this: few exegetes agree on the weight to be given to the role of the editors in the production of the book. I've already talked about that a few times. So few exegetes agree. There's no consensus of scholarly opinion on such matters as the extent to which the Deuteronomists worked on the different levels of the tradition, the relation between the poetry and the prose, the connections between a historical Jeremiah and the tradition about him, the figure of Baruch as an amanuensis, writer, scholar, writer, a biographer, creator of this tradition, or the creation of one level of the tradition and the dating of the book and its parts. So complex that top scholars are still debating elements of it. And I'm trying to give you a line through it that's at least reasonable. The second century BC, another thing about the book we're about to start, and this is a bit surprising, there's no other book quite with this problem. The Septuagint, that is, the Greek version of Jeremiah, is shorter than the Masoretic Hebrew text by as much as a seventh. That's a lot. It's a much shorter text, and it points to there existing a shorter Hebrew text, which was translated into Greek, because the Greek didn't invent it. It's their translators. So they translated, but that text that they translated into Greek is not the text we're reading in the Hebrew. Why this has a problem for us, for you, for me, is that the Bibles today, nearly all, wisely follow the Hebrew right through of the text. But it was the Greek text of this and the Psalms and everything, it was the Greek Old Testament that was the Old Testament for the early Christians. And when Christianity spread into the Greek-speaking world, it was the Greek version that was used. And that became the Latin version, and the Latin version became the ecclesiastical version, the version you get in your Bible, not your Bibles, but in your missals. So when you're given a reference to Jeremiah, I'll make it easier, when I'm given a reference to Jeremiah, I'm a bit bamboozled and I've got to do a bit of work to work out, because it's given me the Greek reference, if it's in the liturgical text, or it's giving me the Hebrew reference if it's in the Bible text. It's a bit difficult. You probably have noticed this in the Psalms, have you? There's usually one difference for similar reasons in the numbering of the Psalms in the Missal and the numbering of the Psalms in your Hebrew Bible, translation of your Bible. So it looks like The formation of the Hebrew text, because the translation into the Greek was about 200 BC, that's a rough enough date for it, 200 years. So if that's translating a Hebrew text, and we've got a Hebrew text that's larger by a seventh, considerably larger, then it looks like that work could well have gone on after the translation into Greek. So Hebrew, it was still going on into the second century before Christ, this wonderful living text. Generation after generation of scribes continued to be fascinated by the clarity of Jeremiah's warnings, but even more so by his conviction, and this is what hopefully we'll be concentrating on the passionate love of Yahweh for his people. Jeremiah is a very passionate prophet. You get his feelings very strongly, and some of them much more objective, if you could put it that way, but with Jeremiah you can't miss it. His heart is bleeding a lot, and that's kind of attractive, really. And he's bleeding for Yahweh as well. Another significant difference between the Masoretic Hebrew text and the Septuagint Greek text is the position and sequence of the so-called oracles against the nations. You find these at the end of the Hebrew scroll, and you find them in the middle of the Greek scroll. So again, it's a complex thing working out where we're going in this. Perhaps the best way, I'm saying this now, and some of the scholars would disagree with me, and a lot of other scholars would say, good, I'm glad you're saying this, because there's debates going on all over the place. Perhaps the best way, my best way, I'll put it that way, to visualise the growth of the scrolls, to think of Jeremiah's usually short statements, typically in poetic rhythms. The prophets were poets. As triggering comment, typically, but not necessarily, in prose. And that this added material in the turn triggered further comment, all with the aim of seeing and conveying the significance of Jeremiah's words in the changed circumstances of later generations. I feel I've overstated all that. I've said it so often to you, but pardon me. Accepting that there's as yet no consensus among Jeremiah scholars, this is the way I'll be dealing with it. Part 1, that's chapters 2 to 25, there's an introductory chapter, chapters 2 to 25, we're starting with an expectation that the poetic sections are Jeremiah's and later scholars have added to it, and will be in fact spending from now right through till the second last presentation will be on chapters 1 to 25. That's the most important part of the Jeremiah scroll, and I'll be doing it thoroughly. Following the Septuagint positioning, part 2 consists in the oracles against the nations. Here we start with an expectation that the prose material and the poetic oracles against the nations represent attempts by later scribes to apply Jeremiah's insights to their changed circumstances. And there's enough in Jeremiah of the punishment and anger of God in the Jeremiah text themselves. I'm not going to do any of the oracles against the nations. If you're fascinated by it and you want to have nightmares every night, and that's the way you like to read the Bible, well, tuck yourself in bed and read the oracles against the nations, and I hope you enjoy it. But I won't be doing it with you. Part 3, different set, they're in different places in the scroll, recounts the life and times of Jeremiah. And I assume they're later creations, except some of the original stuff. And there's some of the most beautiful parts of Jeremiah that you all know come from this section, and I'll deal with them on the final presentation. Now, another little bit of data. I'm finishing with this. And then I'm looking forward, I bet you are too, to me getting on to the blooming prophecy of Jeremiah, which you came for. And I'll do that at 11:15 this morning. Two-thirds of part one, that is, the part we're going to do, chapters 2 to 25, that's leaving aside the oracles against the nations and all the rest of it at the end. Two-thirds of part one, which is really our topic, consist in declarations of divine punishment that was coming upon Judah because of the people's infidelity. The whole of part two consists in declarations of divine punishment that would be inflicted on the surrounding pagan nations. And together, these sections on punishment make up about half the whole scroll. So if you feel I'm giving you a lot of punishment stuff and anger stuff, please don't.